This year, U.S. farmers are bringing in what's expected to be a record-breaking harvest. This hour, we head out to the fields. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Amazingly, it was just last week, before this cold snap, before the snow, that I rode along with Iowa farmer Jim Slodek in his combine on a beautiful, and get this, 65-degree afternoon. We'll listen back to that conversation in this first half hour. Then Amy Mayer and Grant Gerlach of Harvest Public Media join us to talk about the many challenges facing farmers in this record harvest year. First, a look at this hour's news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and today we have a special edition of River to River. If you remember, in the spring, I was out on a farm in rural Johnson County planting. Jim Slodek is joining me again. Actually, I'm joining him. We're out in a field right now that's being harvested. Jim Slodek is managing partner at JCS Family Farms. Jim is a fifth-generation farmer here in Johnson County, and farms thousands of acres, and we're standing outside of his one of the combines he's using to get the corn in this year. Hi, Jim.
How you doing, Ben?
I'm doing well. So tell us a little bit. We'll get a picture for our web, but tell us about the combine we have that we're going to climb into right now.
Well, we're actually looking for new operators, so we thought maybe we'd get you trained here. We'll turn you loose. But this is a 2014 John Deere S670 with a 12-row Gehringhoff rotor disc head. And we're going to jump in here and keep it going.
Okay, let's get the door shut. Okay. We're really quite high up here, and so we're going to take 12 rows at a time, huh, Jim?
Yes.
We're moving, what, 3 or 4 miles an hour, is that right?
Yes.
Okay, the stalks are disappearing very quickly in front of us. They're hitting the front of the combine and just being... What's happening to them after that?
Well, the job of the corn head is to separate the ear from the stalk. And so as you look out there, you see the stalks being pulled down and, you said, disappearing. They're going through the corn head, being shredded and put back on the ground. And then the ear is separated and taken in the throat of the machine where it goes inside. And then it is threshed off the cob, where the grain is separated from the cob. And then there's a series of chaffers and sieves and fans that will separate that grain, the loose grain, from the chaff and the residue, and the rest goes out the back, and hopefully you keep a very high percent of the grain in the tank.
Now we're gonna... Alongside us there, what's happening alongside us? There's a tractor there with a bin?
We just had the grain cart pull up alongside, and we're unloading as we harvest. Grain carts, they hold 1,100 bushels, so they're a good semi-load.
Bushels is the measurement you've been using. So how big is a bushel?
Well, a bushel is kind of deceptive because a bushel is not a volume measurement. It's a weight measurement when you go to sell grain. I mean, it may be approximately the size of a bushel basket, but it has no bearing on volume. It's all weight. And when you sell a bushel of corn, a legal bushel is 56 pounds. So when you say bushels, it's always assumed to be 56 pounds for corn.
Jim, tell us a little bit about overall. You farm thousands of acres in many different counties. What's the overall yield been like this season?
Our yield is very variable this year based on location. As a general rule, the farther south our farms are, the better the yield. The farther north we go, we had more weather challenges. So we're seeing ranges all the way from 150 up to 220 for field average.
When you think back over the season, what was the time in the growing season when you were most concerned? What was happening weather-wise?
Well, that's a tough question. I guess as a farmer, you're always concerned about the weather. It's either too wet or too dry. You're never happy. But I would say the biggest stress we had was the wind event that came through. And, I mean, it flattened thousands of acres. And then they stood back up to varying degrees, and uh, So that was a large yield limiting factor we had. And then I guess then we had 7 weeks of no rain, and of course that's stressful also. I guess as a farmer, it's easier said than done, but I try to focus on things I can change and control, and the weather is obviously not one of those. And so if you're worried about the weather, it'd pretty much drive you crazy.
Also, as we look to the future, there's a lot of discussion about how climate change will affect agriculture in the Midwest here. Do you spend a lot of time thinking about that or wondering what the predictions for our climate change will do to the changing due to farming here in Iowa?
Well, as I mentioned before, I try to focus on things that I can control, and climate change is not one of the things I can control. We've always had climate change. We'll always have climate change. The climate has never stayed the same in the history of the world, so that's a given that's going to change. And what I can do is I can put practices into effect that are the lowest risk practice agronomically for different conditions. So I can try to use practices that work the best if it's too dry, and at the same time would also work if it's too wet. And so it's my job as a manager to try to pick the agronomic practices that lower our risk, because I can't change the weather, and we know it's going to change.
So as you go through the field harvesting here, what are you paying attention to as the operator?
Well, to be honest, right now, this is a field that has a creek along the edge, and so I'm with the high water and the flooding we had this spring and summer, I'm looking for obstacles that have floated into the field that would cause damage to my combine.
Have you run into some things before that you didn't know were in your field when you're harvesting?
Yeah, there'll be logs we farm some close to some urban areas, and we've had bicycles left in the field. It's kind of amazing what you can find in a cornfield. Look at there. There's an example. See, there's a tree limb. Then if that went in the combine, that would create some serious damage. And there goes a piece of it.
What's that sound?
That's a small piece of that limb going through my combine.
I saw a rabbit sprint across the field there a moment ago. There a little bit of wildlife here in these fields?
Oh, you'll see a lot of wildlife. Deer, especially this time of year where they're in rut, you'll see a lot of deer, pheasants, rabbits. Some farms we have turkeys. So yeah, you're seeing a lot of wildlife, and as you harvest more acres, you see more because it becomes more concentrated in the remaining acres. Another thing, when you're harvesting soybeans, you'll see red-tailed hawks, and they're smart enough to know that a combine represents a food source. And as the rabbits run out, you'll watch them just come down and take a rabbit. That's pretty cool, unless you're the rabbit.
So Jim, we've been, it's now mid-November, and we're out on a very pleasant day, somewhere around 60 degrees in the middle of the afternoon, right before the cold snap that's coming in the days to come. When did you start the harvest, and how long will you be at it here?
This year we got a little bit of a late start based off, like I said before, that we had a cool growing season and somewhat delayed plantings this spring, so our maturity was later. So we really didn't start harvest until into October, and we're going to be going through the rest of this month for sure. Hopefully we'll be done by the end of November.
Are you harvesting only during the daytime, or do you get one of these people with the lights out in the field at night?
No, we run at night. We run 6 days a week, quite a few hours.
It's a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. I'm out in a cornfield harvesting. Actually, I'm just sitting in the combine. Jim Sladek is next to me of JCS Family Farms. It's quite an impressive operation. 12 rows at once of the corn disappearing in front of me, being sucked into the, I guess, are those blades or what are they, Jim?
In the corn head, we call those snapping rolls. They're rolls that turn at a very high rate of speed, and they they're timed together, and they grab the stalk and they pull it straight through. And then you can see there's deck, we call it deck plates, above those, and you can hydraulically move those in or out. And the idea is that you want the stalk to go through the deck plate, but you adjust them close enough that the ear cannot. So then the ear gets separated from the stalk at that point, and you can see the gathering chains that are pulling the ears into the combine. See that?
In between
that. Yes, that's what kills people. That's what that's what can grab you. And
what kind of when we talk about modern equipment compared to equipment of generations past, what kind of hazards are here on the farm? We know there are hazards, and people do get injured or even worse every year.
Yeah, I think farming is listed as one of the most dangerous occupations. I think like second only to, I can't recall, mining maybe. You're obviously dealing with a lot of mechanical machinery, and it's much safer today than it used to be. There's a lot more sensors, and I guess I would say it's more idiot-proof. In other words, when you get off the seat, the corn head stops, and you know, previous generations, you always knew somebody that had a missing arm or hand, or that had been injured in a corn head. And this style of corn head, the basic function of this corn head goes back, you know, over 50 years. It really hasn't changed much. And so, but today it's much safer, and we really focus on that with our employees, not to get in a hurry. And this time of year, everybody knows that, you know, time is worth a lot, and so you tend to, you know, hurry, and you're not getting a lot of sleep sometimes, and so we really focus on trying to get people to slow down and think.
Okay, so you've got someone here putting some oil on here. How did he know to put oil on there?
That's one of our grain cart operators, and once a day he'll oil those chains just to make sure that they stay in good shape.
So I'm seeing him move around down there. You want to go back to possible hazards. You want to be aware of everybody moving around your combine outside, don't you?
Yes, you never start a machine without giving an all-clear sign to make sure there's nobody that you don't see. And like I said, we focus on safety. We do a lot of safety training because there, you know, things can happen very fast. And we try to have a culture of safety here and focus on that. And really, the process itself has not really changed a lot in the last 40 years. The creature comforts obviously have improved with the cab and the air conditioning and the radio and the settings and the capacity. I mean, the capacity of these machines is dramatically more than it used to be. But the basic idea of, and the function of a combine really hasn't changed a lot.
We have a new farm bill that's was passed within the past year. How does that fit into your business here? What difference has that made, the new five-year farm bill?
Well, I hate to say this, but it's kind of a non-event. I would prefer if the government was not involved in my business. The main reason that there's a farm bill, it's not the farm bill, it's the Food Security Act. And the main purpose, in my opinion, of the farm bill is to keep prices stable for the consumer. And you know, the subsidy we're receiving now that's actually going away has been like $26 an acre, you know, on farms that are grossing up to $1,000 an acre. So, you know, the last several years, the farm program has not been a major source of revenue, and that direct payment is going away with the new farm bill, so it becomes even less important. The biggest, and I shouldn't say that it's not important, that probably the most important, in my opinion, the most important function is the subsidy we receive on crop insurance. From a risk management standpoint, that's extremely important to help us manage risk. And the government does subsidize crop insurance. And to me, that's a very beneficial area that we utilize in a big way. More so than any direct payment.
Are you generally in agreement with our farm policy in this country, state level, federal level, or do you think we're way off the mark?
On farm policy?
Yeah.
Well, that's a good question. I guess they tend to be off the mark more than they are on. There's so many special interests now that are trying to control a lot of the farm bill. And another issue is, you know, the farm population that does what I do is a very, very small percent. And so we're losing a lot of the voice we have. And, you know, I guess I'm just a free market guy. I just want, you know, I think we're one of the most efficient countries in the world. And I just, the issue I see with the federal government is the regulation that stymies growth. And that, to me, if I look at all the EPA and the rules and regulations that are forced upon us that are making us less competitive in the world, to me, that's the biggest issue that we need to address. I don't need a government payment. I just need the government to not impose rules and regulations that don't make sense, that add to the cost of our production.
Are these the regulations generally from what sector? What concern? Are they environmental regulations or regulations of a different type?
A lot of it's environmental. Just for example, the EPA was, and this has been put on hold, but the EPA was trying to regulate dust coming out of a combine as pollution. Now, you just look around here. Do you know what that would do to, I mean, if we had to control all the dust, the particulates that was leaving this machine, does that make sense?
Granted, it would be a difficult thing, another thing for you to manage.
Well, and another thing you have to realize about farming is we're a price taker. We're not, you know, General Motors can raise the price of the car to offset some of the requirements. I can't raise the price of corn. I have to absorb it as a cost of doing business. So that's one big difference with agriculture.
I'm sitting in the cab of a brand new John Deere combine, and the rows of corn, 12 at a time, 12 rows in one pass, are disappearing into the combine, and what is coming out is what looks like absolutely clean kernels, and what's left is a corn field with a nice thick bed of residue, chopped up corn stalks and so forth, ready for the winter. I'm sitting next to Jim Sladek. Jim is a managing partner at JCS Family Farms. It's a fifth generation family farm operation in Johnson County and several other counties in the meantime, I think, Jim, right?
Yes, we farm ground in six counties here in eastern Iowa. The optical illusion here, see where all the rows are standing, the corn head is standing the rows up. They keep, if it was standing perfect, it would just feed in and disappear. Here, it's almost like a wave that can be almost hypnotic. And a lot of times the auto steer will be driving it, and you'd be sitting there watching, and you're thinking to yourself, if I was driving, I wouldn't be driving right there.
But so the auto steer can sense where it's being guided, what, by GPS? Is that how it keeps, has a better idea than the human eye of where you're going?
Actually, what it does is it's using sense. See the blue arm down, the blue finger on the head? That's sensing the position of the row. It's feeling both rows and keeping it steered. So it's a combination of mechanical and along with the GPS.
So, as we look to the future of farming, this type of farming, corn in the Midwest, you've seen so much technology change and automation really step up to make the process more efficient and less physically demanding. What do you see happening in the future in another generation or two? Where will we be in this type of farming? What will be happening?
Well, you've seen a tremendous amount of automation, but the next big step in automation will be autonomous equipment. That there won't be a seat for you or me, or for the producer. It'll be completely autonomous and driverless equipment, and that technology is almost here today.
So, You're the last generation of farmer that's actually going to be in the field, because I assume that will come with planting too, as it is with harvesting.
Well, it's going to dramatically change what the definition of being in the field means, yes.
So you will be the...
All the skill sets I have will become obsolete.
You say that with a smile.
Well, it's kind of, I think back, what did my dad teach me? I mean, there's a lot of skills my dad taught me they're still relevant today.
Yeah.
But for example, my dad taught me how to drive straight. It was important to be able to drive, be able to plant straight. And it was important to, let's say, to drive straight. Well, now, driving straight, the computer drives straight. I don't need to teach my son how to drive straight. And my son won't have to teach his son how to drive. I mean, it's changing.
How typical is this harvest or this combine for what's going on across and has been going on across Iowa in the last few weeks? Is this I have to believe is sort of the cutting edge of the frontier?
This is very typical. I mean, this is not uncommon. I would say it's very common to see this technology on most larger farms today. I mean, it's definitely not unique.
To be profitable as a farmer these days, do you pretty much have to be operating at this level of technology and with this number of acres?
That's a good question. I would say in the last four years, when the price of corn has been at historic highs, it's not that important. As we move into the future, when prices set back to a more normal price level, it'll become very important.
It makes me think, what would your grandfather or great-grandfather have thought about this operation? I saw some pictures in your office of horse-drawn implements.
Well, I think the first thing it'd be is when you're having a breakdown because of technology and you're not picking corn because some of the technology is not working, he'd look at you and shake his head like, it's 60 degrees out, man. What are you doing? So, no, I think the technology would amaze my grandfather, my father, let alone my grandfather. I mean, it's changed. The last 10 years, it's changed dramatically.
Well, we've come to the end of my very first ride in a combine. Jim Sladek, I want to thank you very much for taking us out and all of the listeners out to understand a little bit about what's going on across Iowa at this time of the year and your thoughts as a farmer and a businessman. Thank you very much, Jim.
I enjoyed having you both out today, and I guess your presence didn't cause any accidents, so we're all happy here.
Very good. Coming up after a short break, we'll hear more from our farmer in Johnson County, Jim Sladek, but we'll also hear from a couple of Harvest Public Media reporters. Iowa Public Radio's own Amy Mayer and Grant Gerlach will discuss a number of the issues that I discussed with Jim Sladek as we focus on the 2014 harvest. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're spending the hour focusing on the 2014 harvest. Last half hour, you heard me riding along in a combine discussing the harvest and many other things with farmer Jim Sladek of rural Johnson County. He's a managing partner at JCS Family Farms. That's a fifth-generation corn producer in eastern Iowa. He runs continuous corn operation there, farming not only his land, but land of others, thousands of acres in five or six counties in eastern Iowa. And as you heard Jim mention, about half of that corn he's now harvesting is in. He's looking to be harvesting, as a matter of fact,
till around Thanksgiving or even after. Joining me now to revisit some of the agricultural issues that I touched on with Jim Sladek is Amy Mayer of Harvest Public Media and Iowa Public Radio. Hello, Amy.
Hi, Ben.
Well, we got zoomed in on one particular farm operation here in eastern Iowa. Give us a bigger picture. How much of the harvest is in overall in corn and beans?
Well, I was a little surprised to hear you say that he only has about half of his corn in, because it's higher than that nationally and even here in Iowa for how much corn is in so far. And for soybeans, I think the soybean harvest may be pretty close to done. So sounds like that large operation in eastern Iowa may be just a little bit behind some of the state and national averages that we've been hearing about.
Mm-hmm. And we had a delay this year because of the type of growing year it was. I wanted to have us listen back to something that Jim talked about in that ride along in his combine. He made some interesting comments about the misconceptions that many of us Iowans, people have about farming, modern farming, and farmers, even in an agricultural state like Iowa.
The way I explain it is, in the past, most people were either farmers, or they were one generation, or at the most two generations removed, so they had a connection back to a farm. Either their parents still farmed or their grandparents farmed, so they had an understanding of what agriculture meant. And today we've broken that connection with the majority of the population. And then also I think agriculture has done a very poor job of telling our story. When you see stories about agriculture, it's almost inevitably a negative story. And I think as farmers, we've done a very poor job of telling our story.
So, Amy Mayer, what about what Jim said there is also true in the experience you have as an agricultural reporter?
It's something that we hear a lot about when we're talking with farmers and trying to set up interviews with farmers, and also when we're combing through the ag media as well as the mainstream media to see what issues are being discussed. One of the things that has happened is the farmers, and in particular the groups who represent them, I think felt a little caught unawares when the public had really vocal and vehement reactions to some of the very sophisticated publicity messages that groups such as the Humane Society were putting out about animal agriculture. And so farm groups, and one that was formed in particular called the U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance, realized they need to get their stories out too, and if they can present their side, they can help to at least give the public a more wide-reaching perspective. For example, one farmer who I interviewed this summer talked about how a tour group came through and they wanted to see a hog operation because they were in Iowa. And this was a conventional farmer with big barns and lots of hogs, crops growing all around them. And he said that some visitors from California were really astonished to see how clean the barns were, how much the farmer cared for his animals. And these are things that any farmer will tell you are routine activities in their production operations. But for a certain segment of the public, these things are surprising. So mm-hmm. Farmers are working hard to make it less of a surprise.
Mm-hmm. We talked about press coverage, giving impressions of farmers and agricultural business. I also asked Jim Sladek to comment about how much he relies on genetically modified seed to produce at the incredible levels that he does.
It has a trait for herbicide resistance with Roundup. It has a trait for below ground protection from rootworms, and it has a trait for above ground protection from corn borers and earworms.
And again, going back to previous generations, you wouldn't have had that. So what difference does the genetically modified corn that you're planting today make in the yields and in the product?
Well, it basically improves it improves the yield by reducing the stress of the plant. I mean, it doesn't make it genetically yield more, but it protects the yield that it genetically has by protecting it from environmental assault, I guess, of insects. Another impact is it reduces the amount of chemicals that we have to utilize, which is, you know, from an environmental standpoint, is very good. We're using the trait to control the insects rather than insecticide.
Jim Sladek there talking about the GMO seeds that he uses. Amy, can you tell us how prevalent GMOs are in most farms today?
Hugely prevalent. I think in Iowa and throughout most of the Corn Belt, the percentage of corn and soybeans planted that come from genetically modified seeds is well over 80%, possibly over 90% this year. I mean, there are fewer crops outside of corn and soybeans where it has such a high representation because there aren't as many varieties available. But certainly here for Iowa farmers, GMO seed is very much in the main.
Of course, GMOs in our news a lot, Amy. Controversial. One of the areas of GMOs that we see coverage on is labeling, whether things should be labeled. And that's been on in the ballot box or at the ballot box, up for vote in some cases, right?
That's right. It recently failed in Colorado, and the Oregon measure was very, very close. I think they were recounting, but it doesn't look like that one would pass. So that leaves only Vermont as having passed a mandatory labeling requirement. What's so interesting is that the prevalence of these GMO corn and soybeans means the vast majority of processed foods are going to contain a corn or soy ingredient that comes from a genetically modified plant. And the level of attention that has been paid on these GMO ingredients or the idea of labeling for GMOs seems a little behind the eight ball when you look at the vast prevalence of those types of seeds in our crops. So there's certainly plenty of farmers who are deliberately growing non-GMO corn and non-GMO soybeans. It will be interesting to see whether the people who have concerns about GMOs actually manage to effect a significant enough change to curb what has become the most conventional way of growing corn and soybeans.
Mm-hmm. And it also makes a difference in terms of our exports. Of course, in Iowa, we export a great deal of our corn and soybeans, and some of the countries, some of the areas we're exporting to are not as open to GMOs as others.
Exactly. And in fact, the very fact that certain regions such as the European Union won't accept any GMO products as imports has helped to support the efforts here in this country to label things as non-GMO, which is completely voluntary, but is a growing trend in the marketplace. And I'm going to be working on a story about that that should be coming out in a couple of weeks.
We've concentrated a lot about on corn because Jim Slodek is a corn on corn farmer. But what can you tell us about this year's soybean harvest?
Also huge, just like the corn harvest. One of the interesting things we've been following at Harvest Public Media is what to do with all those soybeans. Certainly there is a growing export market. There are a lot of outlets for it within the United States. But there are some researchers and businesses that are really thinking about how we might get more out of the soybeans, perhaps with additional industrial applications or other really outside-the-box ideas.
Mm-hmm. So going the way of corn, I don't know which is used for more things, corn or soybeans. We know with corn we make all kinds of things from the things we drink and soft drinks to plastics, all kinds of things, and the same direction for the soybean.
It seems so, yes.
Amy Mayer of Harvest Public Media and Iowa Public Radio. Thanks for joining us, Amy.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and we're spending the hour talking about the 2014 harvest and related ag issues. This year, U.S. farmers are bringing in what's expected to be a record-breaking harvest for both corn and soybeans. The USDA estimates farmers will haul in some 4 billion bushels of soybeans and some 14.5 billion bushels of corn. And those are record-breaking numbers made possible by our producers planting more corn and more soybean acres, but also because of the near-perfect weather here in the Corn Belt. But all that productivity has a big financial downside. Let's talk about that and a few other issues with Grant Gerlach. He's Harvest Public Media's reporter at NET News in Nebraska. Hello, Grant.
Good morning. Good to be on.
First part of our program, out with a farmer this last week, Jim Slodek in southeast Iowa. He mentioned in his talk the drastic drop in commodity prices. How much have the prices dropped?
Well, they hit their highs back in 2012 when some places you were seeing prices for corn around $8 a bushel, which is extremely high. Those were record highs back in 2012. Earlier this fall, beginning of October, they were hitting around $3.20 a bushel, which is the lowest we had seen since 2009. So, I mean, that $5 drop was pretty big and pretty fast, and it was brought on by those huge harvest numbers that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And they've bounced up a little bit since then, about a dollar above that. So things are a little better, but we're still at a point where a lot of farmers are right at that break-even point. They may be making a little bit of money or losing a little bit of money, depending on, you know, how much they spent to put that crop in the ground.
How do farmers cope with what they know, if they've been in the business any time at all, are fluctuating prices?
Well, the difficult thing to handle is their costs at this point. They know what it costs to put that crop in the ground. They know what it costs for the seed, for the fertilizer, for the herbicides and everything. And if they want to make money, if prices stay where they are now, they're going to have to bring their costs down for their fields. And that might mean being a little more judicious about how much fertilizer they put on the field or how often they spray the herbicides, those kinds of decisions they make, or if they're going to use particular insecticides, that might be sort of elective decisions. It's not 100% necessary, but it can help you out if you can afford it. Well, now they may not be able to afford it.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing to think, though, even though we have these record-breaking numbers in terms of corn and soybean harvest, but many Midwest farmers are hoping merely to break even on this year's crop?
Yeah, that's kind of where things are, and especially if it holds on and prices stay at this level next year. I mean, they may be able to get by on savings. Hopefully they were saving money when times were good, and they were able to kind of float through while things are down. But, you know, farmers, if you talk to them, they understand these numbers go up, they go down, and more often than not, they come back up. So it just depends on how quickly all this corn gets used, whether it's used by the livestock industry, the ethanol industry, or whether it goes overseas as exports.
Mm-hmm. Last week, Grant Gerlach, I was in a combine with Jim Slodek, and we heard a bit of that earlier in the hour. I want to hear a little bit more of it right now because I wanted to ask you about some of the high tech going on in modern agriculture. It was amazing to sit in this modern combine. It was a 2014 John Deere combine to see how much is going on. The screens, the software, all linked with GPS to collect data on how fields, but of course not just fields, sections, small sections of fields perform. Let's listen to a couple of minutes of my conversation with Jim Slodek of JCS Family Farms in eastern Iowa.
This is obviously a modern combine. You said a 2014 model. You've got some screens in front of you. What are we seeing on the screens, Jim?
Well, you can see about anything you want. I guess I don't have a DVD player in here, but otherwise it's showing a lot of different functions, I guess. It's showing the guidance function here right now, and then it's also documenting our yield. And I guess the yield, when I say documented, it's documented here, but then also, as you saw, as we unloaded in the grain cart, we have a scale on our grain cart, which is a lot more accurate than the yield monitor. And so every load, every bushel that we harvest goes through the grain cart and gets documented and associated with the field. And then as soon as the cart scale shows the weight, there's a Bluetooth that uploads it to the cloud. I mean, I can pull up my phone any day and tell you exactly how many bushels we've harvested, you know, how many acres we've done, how many we have left. And so the data transfer is pretty amazing.
So you actually, year after year, with this system, you're developing a profile of the field, so you have generations of corn data to look back on, and some then you know some fields are different than others and know what to watch out for? Is that what I'm thinking?
That's very much the case, and in fact, it's changing very dramatically with technology. We've had the capacity to document yield and yield as it varies across the field for 10 years now. But the question is, what do you do with that information? And in the past, it's almost been like information overload without the ability to really make a lot of management decisions. Well, now you're starting to see a lot of technologies come to the market that allow you to manage by the square foot rather than by the field.
Manage by the square foot instead of by the field. That's amazing. Grant Gerlach, he asked a question there that I know you've looked at in some of your reporting. What to do with all that data that gets collected? You've reported on how farmers have concerns about the use of that big data.
Right. As you mentioned, that Bluetooth connection and that data going directly to the cloud, that's a big part of the concern. There are lots of different companies that are offering these services where you can upload your information. They can analyze the data, compare it to climate information and soil information, and come up with different suggestions for next year on how you can plant the field and how you can raise your crop. What farmers are concerned about, they love that advice, but what they're concerned about is what else might be done with that data that that they're providing these companies. They're concerned about just transparency, about companies telling them, are they sharing it with a third party? Are they selling it with a third party? What are those agreements like? And what might those third parties be doing with the data? And this has been a big issue for the Farm Bureau. They've been pushing some of the heavy hitters in this ag data industry to sign on to some specific principles, at least some guiding principles for how this data is handled and what farmers can expect to learn in different licensing agreements when they sign up for these services. And they've just recently come out with a list of some of these principles, and some of the big companies in the industry, including DuPont, John Deere, Dow, Raven Industries is a pretty big one with the guiding systems, a cloud company called the Climate Corporation, which is owned by Monsanto. These companies have signed on to this agreement that they're going to at least provide more information. So they're trying to work with these companies to get to a place where they're more comfortable sharing that information.
Grant Gerlach with me of Harvest Public Media in the last few minutes of this hour, looking at the Harvest 2014. I wanted to share with you, Grant, a little bit more of the audio that I had riding along with Jim Slodek in his combine a few days ago, driving through rural Iowa this time of year. We all see these occasionally these long white tubes stretched out in the fields. I found out what they were. Let's go to the conversation I had with Jim Slodek.
Jim, you pulled a pickup truck to another part. We've got a grain storage system going right now. And this, there are two tractors next to us, and we have this, looks like a long, several hundred foot long sausage stretching out, being made right in front of us. What's happening?
This is an ag bag that we're putting wet corn in for temporary storage. You see the grain cart brings the corn from the combine to the bagger. And we're doing this in the field. It's a very low-cost, very efficient way to get the crop out of the field. At this time of the year, say the middle of November on, there's nothing good that can come from leaving corn in the field. The only thing that's going to happen is potentially field losses from the weather. And so the quicker you can get the crop out and secure it, it's just much better.
Grant Gerlach, these ag bags used widely.
Yeah, more and more often, in the thing that farmers like about it is they don't have to truck that grain far away. They can do it right there in the field and just leave it there and go back and get it when they're ready to take it to whoever they're selling the grain to. And this gets back to the price issue, too, because the one thing that farmers can do to try to play the markets is hold on to the grain. They don't have to sell it right away. They can sell it when they're ready to. So the easier it is for them to store that grain for a longer period of time, the more they can sort of wait and see what happens. That can end up biting them in the end if prices go back down further than they were before. But in a lot of cases, with a lot of farmers holding on to grain, those prices are going to bounce back up, as we've seen over the last 5 weeks or so.
Grant, we have a minute or so left. Let's talk about the Renewable Fuel Standard, commonly called the RFS, a federal program that requires transportation fuel sold here in the U.S. to contain a minimum volume of renewable fuels. Now, it was the boom, the ethanol boom was driven by this RFS standard. It was passed by Congress in 2007 to jumpstart the production of renewable fuels like ethanol. It's had a huge impact on corn growers, the price of corn. What do we know about the future of the renewable fuel standard?
Well, it's a little bit cloudy right now. About a year ago, the EPA made an unusual announcement, and that was that they wanted to reduce that mandate. And it was the first time that they had suggested a reduction in the mandate for corn-based ethanol. And that was made in November last year. It's November 2014 now, and we don't have a final rule. And this is for the rule that was supposed to be for 2014, so 11 months into the year, and we don't know what the final rule is. Farmers are nervous about that because if the ethanol mandate continues to grow, that can help their corn prices.
What would a rollback mean if that would happen?
Well, it's hard to tell how much it would hurt. A lot of ag economists say it probably wouldn't hurt the price that much, but it certainly doesn't help.
Okay, very good. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media's reporter at NET News in Nebraska. Thanks for the perspective from your part of the Midwest, Grant. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And that winds up this edition of River to River, a look at the 2014 harvest. Remember, if you caught part of this program but want to hear the entire hour, we podcast all of our programs. Go to iowapublicradio.org. You can download any of the programs you've heard on our talk shows, download or listen to them on your favorite computer or device. And while you're there downloading the podcast, you'll want to check out the pictures and also some really cool video that we took while we were out at Jim Sladek's farm of the modern harvest going on. Go to iowapublicradio.org and search for River to River. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Claire Roth. We had help today from Garrett Van Leeuwen. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.